Hi, my name is Allison Mead, and welcome to What She Said, an episode of the LA FPI's podcast series. The Los Angeles Female Playwrights Initiative is dedicated to encouraging and promoting the work of female playwrights. And today I'm going to be speaking with Anastasia Kuhn, whose play Gracie and Rose is currently playing at the Art of Acting Studio as part of the Hollywood Fringe Festival. Anastasia is an actor appearing in The Real Thing, Measure for Measure, Antigone, The Way of the World, and Boy Gets Girl, among many others. She's also a voice and movement teacher, currently on faculty at the USC School of Theater, New York Film Academy, and the Art of Acting Studio, and has been a movement coach on many, many additional productions. So welcome, Anastasia.
Hi, Allison. Thank you so much. It's so nice to be here.
Well, at the heart of your show, Gracie and Rose, is the idea of love, which I love. So how love happens, how it carries forward, how it endures no matter what. So I wondered what you loved about this idea originally for the show and what drew you to it to begin with.
Oh, my gosh. You're so sweet. What a beautiful question. Yes. Yeah, I love it that I'm being redundant, but I appreciate that you see that it's a love story because to me that's what it is. And different people take away different things depending on their level of experience with gay and lesbian people and their level of knowledge about queer history and American history in the West. Because to me this is just straight up American history. Gracie and Rose is about two women living on a ranch in the late 1950s in Wyoming. And they fall in love, and they have no idea what that means. They are just flying on instinct. And they fall in love at a time when Gracie has been passing and living as a man for about 7 years when she meets Rose. And for a variety of reasons, she's passing as a man, and one of which is to do men's work because it's what she loves. At this time, that includes wrangling wild horses and sheep herding and doing ranch work, and it's the kind of work that she loves, but also so she has her independence and gets paid more to do men's work, and it's just who she is. It's how she's comfortable in her own skin. So they fall in love and find a way to be together at a time and place. Wyoming is a big, wide-open space, and they're in a rural environment at a time and place when there's no reflection back of what they're doing or who they are. There's no language for their sexuality or their sensuality or their feeling. You know, sort of a stoic, you know, very men were men and nobody talked about their feelings. And also this is a part of some of the source of where this story comes from is I worked on a farm in France in the early, I guess, 1999 for a period of a couple months. And it was also a theater center, so lots of artists were coming through and workshopping their performance work. But what really struck me was the incredible demands of the land and the animals. And so I, at that time, I took part in a pig slaughter. I assisted in a pig slaughter, and that was very eye-opening.
Wow.
Right? I'm kind of I wouldn't say total city girl, but I certainly have lived in a lot of different cities, you know, and that kind of rural agricultural life was new to me. So I loved to learn about it and be in it. But at any rate, I just observed that the two people that were running the farm, a man and woman, were partners and had a two-year-old and another baby on the way. There was no time to take care of the relationship and talk to each other and nurture that part of Mother Nature that was all around us. And so, and it had a cost, you know. And my dad's side of the family and my own family are Iowa farmers. And it's also generational and cultural and, you know, a lot of different things. But I just observed that in family systems where people can't talk to each other about what's actually happening, there's a consequence. So that is certainly in the story between Gracie and Rose. But when it comes to gay and lesbian people specifically living in different a system that has its own set of pressures and pressures that are unique to that experience, when you are deprived of language to describe your feelings or your to name what's happening to you, you're really at it has a cost also. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of the pressure cooker that I've put Gracie and Rose into. And also, I would say when I'm having a hard gay day, you know, when I'm hearing about awful things happening and hate crimes and people being hurt because of how they are perceived in their gender identity or sexuality, and families being hurt, then I just think, oh my gosh, I'm living at this time when I'm so fortunate that I have so much support, and I live in urban environments where there's consciousness and reflection back and community and language. How in the world did my elders do this, you know, in isolation? So coming back to your question, yeah, Gracie and Rose is a love story. It's kind of love by any means necessary. Sometimes I describe the play as Gracie and Rose living off the land and loving off the grid, you know? And just to tie in this idea of passing in plain sight, and that people find companionship and create family without hurting anybody else in a way that makes sense to them, no matter what, you know? And that's an impulse that we all have and need to fulfill. And people do terrible things in the name of family, but this story has some wonderful things in creating family and finding a way to do that, even as it doesn't match the people around them, you know?
Well, you also touched on it a little bit in what you were just saying, but location is also a really important part of your play. So how does the landscape of Wyoming play into the staging of Gracie and Rose?
Yes. So I grew up traveling a lot, but mostly in Arizona. So I'm familiar with the sensation of wide open spaces and heat, you know, extreme weather.
Right.
And but also just open sky, you know, and open land and open air and winds and how that has a liberating effect on people and also has other effects. So the ironic thing is I've not been to Wyoming. And a part of me feels really remiss in that because I'm such a nerdy, you know, nerdy dramaturgy theater girl, and I feel beholden to accuracy. And so I feel like, oh, this is a sham. I'm making up a false Wyoming. And a part of that might be true. To me, Wyoming is a bit of a metaphor for wide open space and a demanding, harsh place to live. And in my research, that is the deal. But what beautiful things come out of that adversity and, you know, and the defiance against the elements or cooperation with the elements and with the land and the animals, all of those different relationships build strong people and build strong character. So also it's set in Wyoming because one of my inspirations for this story was Annie Cruz's short story, Brokeback Mountain. I bumped into that. Yeah, I bumped into a collection of her short stories, and Brokeback Mountain was in that collection a few years before it was made into a film, which was wonderful. And the way she writes, I mean, she's just brutal in the way that she harnesses the land as the cauldron for her characters to be at the effect of. She also wrote the Shipping News, so that's a whole different harsh environment, Maine, you know, sub-zero temperatures and winds and colds and isolated people. Making community, so that's a part of the presence of the land. But in terms of the staging, you'll just have to come see it. But also,
I'm going to come see it, definitely.
I'm excited. That'll be great. I look forward to that. But also, I take a part of the way I was trained as an actor is in the tradition of Commedia dell'arte and have sort of a poor man's theater aesthetic, you know, having a couple objects on stage with you, and they transform. You harness, the hope is to harness the audience's imagination to transform the objects into multiple things, animals, objects, environments. So that's my job, and if I'm doing my job well, then that happens.
Well, you also chose to make it a solo show, kind of a good transition here. With you playing a variety of different parts. So how did you prepare to play all those different roles?
Yeah. I just think solo shows are so honorable. It's sort of the ultimate acting challenge and opportunity. Mm-hmm. And I was brought up, I always get confused when people are like, I don't like solo shows, just completely, as the whole genre. I'm like, are you kidding? You obviously haven't seen the good ones, you know, because there's, you know, bad writing and art in all forms. But
I think I fell into that at one point, but I've changed my ways.
Oh, yay!
I've definitely changed my ways.
Oh, good. But I'm so fortunate. Like, I grew up going to see live performance constantly. We didn't have a TV in the house, no popular movies. It was all historical stuff, documentaries, VHS tapes of Nova on PBS. And so we were going to live performance all the time and also traveling internationally. My dad was a physics professor. And
okay.
So he was just really good at harnessing the opportunity to collaborate with in academia, with, you know, other professors and friends and colleagues in Australia and Portugal and Germany and wherever. And so so we would see live performance as we were traveling.
Yeah.
So as part of that, I've seen amazing performance all over the planet, but also it just became a habit to see performance all the time. And I'm so lucky that I've gotten to see Anna Deavere Smith live and the NEA4 at different times in their careers, you know, Karen Finley and Holly Hughes and John Fleck, who's amazing in here in Los Angeles, and Tim Miller. And then the tradition of queer theater coming up, Peggy and Lois and the Wow Cafe and Deb Margolin and just all these incredible artists. Which is how I was schooled and what I would be honored to even, you know, get close to in terms of my work. So to me, a solo show is the ultimate opportunity for actors to really work your chops. And I guess I chose to make this a solo show because I've been carrying it around with me for many years, developing it in stages in between other projects or going to grad school for my MFA for acting or getting cast in plays or working in film and TV or moving to Los Angeles. You know, it's been a kind of gypsy itinerant past 20 years following opportunities for acting. And so by having a solo show in my back pocket that I could work on when I have the space, that's been a real treat and more conducive to me though being able to do that when it's a solo show.
Got it.
I also love performing cross-gender. It's super fun. Mm-hmm. So in this play, I play the butch, Gracie, the femme, Rose, and then their daughter. Oh, my gosh, how does that happen? You'll have to come and find out. And one of the ranch hands that Gracie goes out with, Ethan, goes out on a feral horse hunt. And somebody else. Oh, Margaret, a neighbor. So, again, that's a real opportunity to work with the tools that we have, voice and spine and gesture and rhythm and tempo and style and shape, you know, and that's what I teach. I teach movement for actors, and so the teaching keeps me honest because if I'm teaching my students to work hard and do this, then I have to also. It was just a really cool creative opportunity, and I'm so lucky to have it.
Well, the play also touches on the idea of becoming visible. It becomes more and more important as the play progresses, and I never like to give too much away because I want people to go out and see the show, but one character in particular is struggling with this idea. So how does that theme play into the work, and why is visibility so crucial today?
Well, so I typically date butches, or what, you know, the slang is, butches or soft butches, meaning women that a straight world or heteronormative perspective or male gaze would clock as masculine femininity. I happen to think it's hot, you know, desire is like a twisty thing for each of us. And so that's my jam. And I love it. So at any rate, I've just noticed since I came out and started being with women that if I'm with my girlfriend at the time and she's, you know, 6'2" and rocking a tie and has a crew cut and we're out in public. But this has been all my girlfriends. She gets third more often than not. And I'm just like, you're not paying attention. People aren't paying attention. And these are curvy women. Like, it's not hard. It's not difficult to pay attention. But, man, if people are just cruising along and not paying attention and thinking and just needing to address someone in a gendered way really quickly, then my girlfriends, and also by virtue of being with me because I pass for straight or I'm femi or whatever, then we need opposition, I guess. So then the addressing turns into a stir. Or we'll be at a museum and my girlfriend will ask where the restroom is and the museum guard will say, oh, the men's restroom is that way. And yeah, so that's the visibility thing. And I used to get so mad and like, and just because it's just rude to not see the person, like see what you're, you know, see the person in front of you. It's not difficult. And my girlfriends would have different ways of processing it, or, you know, they've been handling it for a long time. And so, and sometimes it was really fun and sexy and playful to be like, yeah, that's right. That's right. We're getting away with something, you know? And that's what Gracie, and that's essentially what Gracie and Rose do. They pass in plain sight as a straight couple for decades. And, which I think is sexy and hot, you know, out of necessity at that time and place, but they do it. And there's something really delicious and satisfying about that. But also in my research, this is nothing new. I'm not telling any new story here. You know, it might be new to folks because we're deprived of queer history in the United States and so many marginalized people's history. Then it seems like a new story, but it's the oldest thing in the world. There's documented instances of women passing as men around the world throughout different time periods, Aboriginal women out on the sheep herding hunt passing as men so they could be with their husbands for months at a time out on, you know, on the herd experience. And then and in the United States, all over, the Virgins of Albania is a whole other really amazing instance of, you know, in Albania when so many men, boys and men, were being killed in the war, a woman would be sort of selected naturally coming up in the ranks to be the father figure and would start to dress like a man and pass and become sort of the man of the house or the man of the village, you know, there'd be a few in this position and smoke cigarettes and exchange cigarettes like business cards and get a crew cut and live the rest of their days as a man to fulfill the need in the family system, you know. And then in the United States, the first Wells Fargo stagecoach driver was a woman named Charlene, who went by Charlie Parker, for decades, for like the last 40 years of her life. And she was a badass, and she was driving the stagecoaches and driving people to safety. She was a stagecoach driver for hire. So she drove for Wells Fargo Company for many years, and then when that dried up, she had her own business, taking people, you know, as a passenger stagecoach, and she'd take them over these like rocky cliffs and around the bend, and at one point her eye got kicked out by a horse, and she wore an eye patch the rest of her life, and she wore gloves to cover up her small hands, but she was a roustabout. She was like Popeye, you know, and she was the first woman to vote in the United States by virtue of being a biological woman, even as she was passing as a man at that time. And she wasn't discovered until this is typically how it happens with all these women passing in their adult life at the time of autopsy. Then it'll be discovered, oh, my gosh, this is a woman's body. And then immediately, because it's salacious or perceived as needing to be such, it's put in the newspapers. I mean, when else do you – that's so, you know, invasive to out somebody when they're dead. But anyway, so
– it sounds like your next –
so it would be in the
– for sure.
Pardon?
It sounds like your next play, for sure.
And then, but there's other instances of, like, passing is in all marginalized cultures. Like, there's all these instances of light-skinned African-American jazz musicians passing as white so they could play in white clubs and make more money. But I mean, there were women passing as men to be soldiers in the Revolutionary War, the Civil War, and maybe, again, to be with their husbands, not necessarily to be partnered with a woman, but just to have the independence that they were craving, and also the freedoms and the privileges and the money, you know, to be have more economic opportunity than being a maid at this time, at these times. So I think it's fascinating.
It is. It's very fascinating. You decided to bring Gracie and Rose to the Hollywood Fringe Festival this year, and I wondered why, for you, that seemed like the perfect venue for what you're doing.
Yeah, a couple of things. The Fringe is fringy, and you get to try out new stuff, and I have other friends who are artists in the festival, and we sort of dovetail on each other's momentum and support each other. And I've made so many new friends and have such strong community through the Fringe Artistic Circle, which I really appreciate. It's a system you can just plug into, insert show here. And also my venue is one of the schools where I teach. I teach movement for actors at the Art of Acting Studio in Los Angeles, and it's the Los Angeles branch of the Stella Adler studio at New York University, and it's run by Stella Adler's son, Tom Oppenheim, is the artistic director.
Okay.
So Yeah, so the Art of Acting Studio has been so good to me. They're my venue for the Hollywood Fringe Festival, also for the I Am a Theater Fest one-act play series. And so by virtue of it being a place where I teach, I'm very familiar with the venue. So that's a real asset. And they've just been really generous with me, treated me like a family member. And so that was a cool opportunity to harness too. And, yeah, so it's been great. Really enjoyed the Fringe aspect. And so creative. Like, you get to do all these fun things. We're going to have a – they've invited us to do a cocktail, have a show-themed cocktail at the Fringe Central Bar, which is, like, the hangout space for everybody and where we have parties and awards shows and stuff. And so on Thursday, June 17th, from 7 to 11 at the Fringe Central Station, we're going to be serving our cocktail called the Stone Butch. And my friend Todd Handelsman crafted the recipe. And it's got bitters, and I believe it's bourbon-based. It's kind of a old-fashioned with a twist, but kind nice. Of trying to do like a salty-sweet thing, like to get the butch and the femme energy in the drink. It's fun.
Classic. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me today. I'm wishing you lots and lots of success with the run.
Thank you, Allison. Thank you so much. It's been so nice to hang out and chat about the show. I appreciate it.
Sure. Gracie and Rose runs at the Art of Acting Studio in Hollywood until June 29th. It stars Anastasia Kuhn and is directed by Sheree Adams. For more information about tickets, please visit www.hollywoodfringe.org/projects/1372. For more information about LAFPI's resources, activities, and opportunities, please visit www.lafpi.com.